Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. We have a mix of matters set for our hearing calendar today, July 25, 2019. The first case, I'll ask our marshal to call.
A18-2114, Nicole Marie Edwards, petitioner, appellate, Michael Edwards, responder.
And counsel, you're obviously both familiar with appellate procedure. Go ahead and introduce yourself and the party you're speaking on behalf of when you're ready to go.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is John Burns, and I represent the appellant, Nicole Krause. The parties were divorced by stipulated judgment and decree on April 1, 2014. At that time, they agreed that their five-year-old son would be in Ms. Krause's sole physical custody, and Mr. Edwards was awarded parenting time of alternating weekends from Friday at 5 p.m. to Sunday at 5 p.m., and every Thursday from 5 p.m. to Friday at 8 a.m. Mr. Edwards brought a motion in February 2018 to expand his parenting schedule to include Wednesdays and Thursday overnights every week, and to expand the weekends from Friday through Monday. By order filed July 5th, 2018, Judge McManus granted Mr. Edwards' motions and expanded the parenting time to include one additional overnight every 2 weeks. He would now have the Monday overnight following Ms. Krause's weekends. A review hearing was then scheduled for August of 2018. And Mr. Edwards brought a motion at that point to...
A review hearing for what?
The court indicated that they were implementing a schedule and that they were putting it on for a review hearing. They didn't designate the detail of what was to be reviewed or what was to be considered. It's merely referred to as a review hearing.
Okay.
Mr. Edwards then brought a motion in conjunction with that review hearing asking to further modify the schedule and to seek his 50-50 parenting schedule. He also asked for a retroactive application of child support. On October 2nd, the district court entered its order and granted the request to move to a 50-50 parenting schedule, denied the request for the child support issue, and referred those issues to the administrative process. We brought a motion for amended findings, as did Mr. Edwards. Both motions for amended findings were denied, and this appeal follows. On appeal, we are raising two primary issues. One, did the district court fail to make any best interests findings to support its after-the-fact claim that it had applied the best interest standard? And two, did the court's order constitute a de facto modification of custody?
Well, can I ask you a question on that? Now, I think there were two orders that modified the father's parenting time.
That is correct.
And as I understand it from the argument that is made by counsel for the respondent, there was no appeal from that first order.
No, that is correct. And so what we've argued is that with the review hearing, that the two orders need to be read together, that is the incremental or piggyback change, as we call it in our brief, is the is what we're identifying as the appeal. Effectively, you go from three overnights every 14 days to seven overnights, and that the case law supports that conclusion, that you need to read it in conjunction.
What authority can you point us to that would support that position?
On page 11 of my brief, I detail the analysis under MJH and Crowley. Both precedents where multiple orders are used to incrementally increase parenting time and affect a de facto change of custody without the required evidentiary hearing. And that's really what we're looking at here. You get from a base level of parenting to 50-50 without having to go through that criteria of endangerment, without having the Nice-Peterson analysis, without needing to meet the burden. And it is our argument that under that series of cases that was a reversible error. Now, Judge Hooten is right that respondent argues that Crowley doesn't apply, but it's our position that they are incorrect. And I respond back to that in my reply brief on pages 3 and 4. And I indicate to the court that the precedent really is as simple as this. A party cannot incrementally accomplish a change of custody without meeting the statutory requirements.
Well, and as I recall the Crawley case, those were temporary changes in parenting time.
They were.
And isn't that a distinguishing factor here, or is it a distinguishing circumstance? Because here, it was not intended, at least the first order, was not intended to be a temporary order. It was a permanent order.
And we addressed that as well in our reply brief. But to put a highlighter on that, if I can, we do not believe that it is distinguished. And we provide the reasoning is that the orders, when taken in conjunction, show the series of expansions. And that, therefore, I also provide in our reply brief some additional case law responding to that argument. So I provide the Spanier case on page 3, and the precedent to say that what you have here, this course of action by Judge McManus at the lower court to, through the two orders, get to 50-50, is right in line with the precedent that has come previously.
And MJH.
That's correct. MJH and Crowley both apply. We've also argued, so I mean that's the de facto argument, and I think that's quite honestly our strongest argument, that we have a de facto change of custody.
Well, was that argument made to the court though? Because that's the other argument that's being raised by counsel for the respondent, that argument was never raised before the court, and
right.
Therefore it's forfeited.
Yes, they do make that argument. I respond to that in pages 1 and 2 of our reply brief, and I say that the issue was raised in our motions. Neither of these appellate counsel were representing the parties at the district court. I came in at the time of the motion for amended findings. Respondents' counsel joined at the appeal.
Well,
but
do you agree that if the first time it was raised, it was during the motion for amended findings, it's too late?
If there was no other reference to it. But there is reference that they said that the wrong standard was applied. My predecessor made that statement. The other thing is that the...
When did he make that statement?
It was she, Your Honor, and I know that there was a reference to it. I can find that and provide you with that detail.
Is that a reference at the review hearing?
It was a reference at the first hearing, Your Honor.
First hearing.
Yeah, the very first. So in conjunction with the original motion. And there was a lot of argument about did respondent have the obligation to lay the law out to Judge McManus? Did my client, through her previous counsel, have that obligation, or did the judge have the obligation independent? What we put into our reply brief is that the fact is that Judge McManus did consider all of this. The issue was raised. He did consider fully the issues that I had in front of him. And I also point out that it's an important issue that was fully considered by the court below and should be considered here today. It's been fully briefed.
At some point, did Judge McManus acknowledge the issue and indicate that he was not considering it a custody situation?
In particular, when I was arguing in front of him, the transcript itself goes through in great detail that he understands that.
He had
that.
An ample opportunity at that point to make a modification and apply the correct standard.
He did, absolutely.
And what is the reason for why we would say you have to raise it below? It's to give a trial judge an opportunity, isn't it?
It is, but you know, in these are not unique issues. People change custody and seek to expand their parenting time all the time.
The cases that talk about only being able to raise it on appeal if you raised it below, are any of those cases family law cases?
They were not. There's nothing that matches this on all four corners, Your Honor.
JMH versus Ashoff?
I don't have that case.
I don't have that opinion.
Okay.
And it seems to be exactly what has occurred here. But if you're not familiar with it, I won't
All right.
ask further. Plus, it's unpublished, and the problem with that is, of course, it's not precedential.
Right. And again, I think what distinguishes this, and in your honor, Judge Werke, I don't have familiarity with that case, but I think a distinguishing factor here is the fact that Judge McManus, when I argued that he was making a change of custody, when I argued all of this, it was fully briefed, it was fully argued, he considered it, and then he came out with his amended order where he said, no, I don't think adding one additional day is a change of custody. And that's the other fact that I think he misunderstood.
Because he was referring to the prior order as opposed to the original order.
That is correct. That is correct.
So tell me what happens or what you see happening if this is sent back to district court. I mean, where do you start? Do you start with arguing whether there should even be a change?
You do. You do. Judge McManus, you know, very honestly in the transcript, and you can read it, says that he may be wrong, that he may be making a mistake, that it very well may come back to him, but that he thought that just adding the one day to the calendar was not a change of custody. And I think that shows exactly what we have here, which is that he didn't understand the stipulated agreement that the parties had and the substantial expansion that he had made on that. And I don't think that he understood that just based upon his very own comments. I think that he needs to start with the analysis of saying, if respondent's request is to go from what he stipulated to at the time of the decree to this 50-50 schedule, does he meet the endangerment criteria? Is there a nice Peterson hearing? It's great to have the lawyers argue it. It is. I mean, that's what we do. But at some point, to really get to the credibility and make a determination, the parties need to testify. They need to put in their evidence. There needs to be that opportunity for the district court.
Could I, because I mean, probably their strongest argument is, or the respondent's strongest argument is that this argument wasn't made below. And I can kind of, I can see how this occurred because on the first motion,
right.
It's just a small, you know, it's not a huge substantial change.
Correct.
But if you put the two together and compare it to the original, it's a bigger change. Was that ever argued that this amounted to a change in custody at any point? Either
yes.
I assume it was, if it was made, it had to be probably made at the second motion.
Yeah, it was argued very well because I argued it at the
Not for the amendment or the motion,
right?
The rehearing motion, but on the second motion for additional parenting.
I've reviewed the transcript there. In response to the original question, it was raised that there was a concern about the law being applied and the standard, but it wasn't developed. It wasn't argued to the fine point. I did absolutely bring it up, and the judge then took the step of saying, I did do the best interest analysis, but to our brief, there's no best interest analysis in here either. There's no endangerment evaluation. There's no best interests.
All right, so when you say you argued it was the wrong standard, what was argued at the second motion? Because if you had this argument,
right,
it would have been then, not at the first motion.
Correct,
right?
Correct. Yeah, I argued that absolutely the court needed to do the nice Peterson analysis, had to determine whether a prima facie case of endangerment had been made, and only then, if that had been made, would they be entitled to a hearing to determine if a change of custody was appropriate. I worry that this is a backdoor approach to get a change of custody without having to clear that hurdle. And that precedent is long established in Minnesota, and it's there for a reason. If you're going to change the child's day-to-day and week-to-week life, you have to make a higher finding.
Well, I don't know. I don't think anybody disagrees with that. That's pretty clear as far as what the law is. But the problem that we're struggling with is where we're at now when this wasn't considered below. And of course, in order to effectuate what you've just stated, we have our rules and we have
right.
the manner in which it comes up, and that's, I don't know what to do about that. I'm looking for a case that would help us carve that out.
Right. I think that the case law that I provide in our reply brief gives you the roadmap to get there, Your Honor. I believe that it does. I know there's been decisions as recently as January where there's been some similar in an unpublished case, Leschinsky, L-E-S-C-H-I-N-S-K-Y, has some similar analysis where they get there as well. And where the comparison in Leschinsky is that the court did a lot more than what our judge has done here. There's not best interest analysis, merely a statement that he says he did look at the totality of it, but there's no analysis. There's no endangerment analysis. Really what you have is a judge saying, I think I'm just adding one day, when he's added 3 days every 2 weeks, when he's taken one half of the school days per year that the child has and now upended the agreement that the parties had. For those reasons, we're asking for the decision to be reversed. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Kaynard Hunt, and I represent the respondent, Christopher Edwards. Respondent's asking that the court affirm. I think it's important to go back through the record here. Respondent brought two relevant motions, both seeking to modify his parenting time. He did not move to change custody. What the record reflects is that both parties each produced what they viewed as relevant facts, albeit oppositional, as to what constitutes the best interest of the child. At no time prior to the trial court's order of October 2, 2008, did appellant assert that respondent's motion seeking an increase in parenting time constituted a motion for a de facto change in custody so that respondent must demonstrate endangerment.
Well, could we stop with that? Because we have two things going on here, and one is whether the correct standard was applied by the court.
Right.
And then there's the issue of whether, if it's the best interest, whether there are sufficient findings.
Right.
And we can talk about both. But going back to the last statement you made, the question I have in all of this is what, assuming that this had been, the motions had been considered together, in other words, assuming that this is a 50%, it goes to being a 50-50 situation, which is what was asked for in the MJH case. Were it not for the procedural issues that you've raised, wouldn't this be on all fours with the MJH case, actually?
No, because MJH, the Supreme Court made very clear that simply a 50-50 parenting time is not a modification of custody. So the idea that request is in itself a modification of custody is certainly not in accord with what the Minnesota Supreme Court said.
But I'm looking at the holding in that case, and it says we hold that in determining whether a motion to modify parenting time is a de facto motion to modify physical custody for purposes of deciding whether the endangerment standard applies, the court should consider the totality of the circumstances to determine whether the proposed modification is a substantial change that would modify the parent's custody arrangement. And in this case, I mean, this is, factually, it's not that much different than what the father was asking for in MJH.
Well, I think it is factually different, but
Why is it factually different?
Well,
please.
For one thing, in MJH, the father had not week on, week off during the school. He lived in Iowa. There was, like a two-hour back and forth transportation. They're all different facts than what this case. Here we have a situation that under the judgment and decree, actually, it provided that there could be the flexibility of parenting time. In fact, respondent, was heavily engaged during the week with the child, had the child at, many other times other than the strict parenting time in the original judgment and decree. So, I mean, it really isn't like, it isn't like MJH at all factually. But I think it's important to go back and look at the procedural history of this case, because when a respondent made his motion in February, he was actually asking for 50-50 parenting time. And there was no assertion made there by the appellant that, oh, you're asking for de facto modification of custody. So that's the first time. And there the trial court granted respondent 5 out of 14 days. So it wasn't the 50-50. Okay, now that order is a final order. It was, there was a notice of filing order. The appeal time expired in September of 2018. So whatever happens here, that order is final. So when respondent again sought...
Let me ask you, what was the review hearing? If that order was final, why was there a review hearing?
That's interesting, because the court just puts that on there, but there were some other things in that order, such as taking the child to church. There were some other things in that order. But there was not anything in the order itself that in any respect as to parenting time suggests that it's temporary. I mean, the court says you shall have.
Usually to evaluate how things are going and to see whether we're going to continue it or do something else.
But it's still a...
And when that happens, not so sure I want to accept the proposition that it is a final order.
It is a final order. It's an appealable order.
Well, that's another question.
Well, no, that is because...
My point is that it looked like the court treated it as something that it wanted to take another look at.
Well, I mean, it did put a review hearing, but as far as parenting time, it shall be this. Now, sometimes you have these orders where the court says, until this time, it's going to be this. So you can look at it and say, yeah, that's a temporary order. But that's not how this order is written. And this order could have been appealed, and it was, and the time ran after the notice of filing order. It is a final order. It's an appealable order. And that's important, because you can't say you have to decide what it is. And that was the problem in the Meyer case. In the Meyer case, what we had there was not these parenting time orders. What we had was the parties had stipulated to joint legal and physical custody, and then there was an ex parte order or motion made by the father shortly thereafter to grant him sole physical custody. What happened thereafter was there was a series of other temporary orders, and they said they were temporary. And the court always in those orders said that, you know, I've got it to a parenting consultant, and, you know, hopefully you can get back to joint legal and physical custody. So the Minnesota Supreme Court actually, in a footnote, rejects the idea that there were de facto orders modifying custody in that case. They were all temporary orders. So that's why, looking at the Crowley case, I never understood why that in any respects supports appellant's position in this case.
And there is nothing, there's nothing you can point to in the order that says that it's temporary.
Nothing, no. And see, in Crowley, they did say temporary. You know, and it is important because in Crowley...
What did it say about the review? What was the language of the court about the review
in
this case?
It says it's subject to review.
Subject to review? It actually said a specific date, did it not?
August 24th.
That's not subject to review. It means it will be reviewed on that day.
Right, it will be reviewed on that date, but the parenting time is clear that it shall be this. So, you know, it's final. So now what we have is we go on to the next motion. Now respondent again sought 7 overnights in 14 days. Respondent only asserted it would not be in the child's best interest. Again, not asserting that there was any de facto modification of custody by this motion.
It is asserted in the motion for amended finding.
Right, and that's too late.
Why is it? Any case that says that's too late?
Yes, I've cited to you the Allen case.
Yeah, none of those are family cases.
Well, I can cite to you Court of Appeals unpublished decisions.
Do you have any family published cases?
No, but I don't think why family law, somehow we have different rules that apply to family law than we do to any other rules of civil procedure.
I might want to quarrel with you on that proposition.
Well, I know you might, but I disagree because, I mean, we have to have, you're subject to the rules of civil procedure, you're subject to the rules of civil appellate procedure on appeal. And so when you're looking at motions to amend, you cannot bring up a new theory, you cannot change a theory, and the idea being that, you know, both parties, when you're sitting before the district court and you can make your record, you know, you can do that, you know, in the context of the motion, but in a motion to amend, you can't add to the record. You can't bring in an affidavit. So that's why it's important that you're not switching theories or adding something in a motion to amend.
Okay, can I ask you this? Because I think you're claiming that as to the second motion, that the argument wasn't made. But wasn't the argument made that the endangerment portion of the statute should be applied?
Not with regard.
They're arguing the Peterson case
and not
prima facie.
There's no
evidence.
Such argument prior to the October 2nd order. That's made in their motion to amend.
Okay, it wasn't made during the motion portion.
No, I have the transcript. You can look at the filings of the parties. There was the transcript of the August 24th hearing. What's interesting is the judge talked, the parties were there. The judge asked some questions. I see nothing in this transcript that suggests that the appellant was asserting that what respondent was requesting was some kind of de facto modification of custody.
Well, I'll accept that they didn't say de facto change of custody.
And it only spoke in terms of the best interests of the child.
Okay, all right. Is there basically a concession that the best interest factors apply as opposed to?
I don't see anything.
Endangerment standard required?
I don't see anything other than that. There is, what the mother, the appellant was arguing, saying, well, you know, maybe down the road, when the child's a little older, we can look at having what he's requesting now. But I don't see anything that is asserting that anything close to, you know, you're applying the wrong standard, judge. You know, this should be a modification standard. Nothing like that. And I think you'd have to be, you know, fairly specific. So what we have is we don't have anything until the motion to amend where this is raised. So it is our assertion that, you know, what we have is it's the best interest of the child, the parenting time, and the trial court should be affirmed.
Well, then I think you also raised in your briefing that even if it had been raised, what the judge at the time of the second motion would have had to compare was what the request was with the prior order. Am I correct?
Right. So what we have here is we have five overnights in the February or the July order. And then you have seven in the October. The judge was wrong in saying it was an increase just to one night. It was two, but he was correct in saying it's 50-50. So I don't see that is, you know, a material error.
Okay. I see you only have 2 minutes left.
The case law that talks about it's too late to make that kind of motion for at a time of amended findings, what was the posture of that case? Because I'm looking at it here. The purpose of this is to give the trial court the opportunity to make a correction on its own if it wants, once it's alerted to the fact that it may be the wrong standard that was used. And it looked like the trial court even took that opportunity because it responded by saying, no, I don't think so, because it's just a one-day change. so we're using best interests. It seems to me that all the purposes of giving the trial court an opportunity to be heard before you come to appeal have been met here, and in fact, the trial court addressed it. Whether it should have or not, on a motion for amended findings, it did address it, and in my view, addressed it wrong because it decided that, well, it only made a one-day modification.
Well, this court held in the Raworth versus Raworth, which is an unpublished decision, that the court would actually abuse its discretion if it is making a change based on an argument raised for the first time in a motion for amended findings, and that's a family law case. So what you have here, and the problem, I think, fundamentally is this. If the argument is made when it's being presented to the district court before it rules, the parties have the opportunity to submit additional evidence. But once the court rules, that record closes. So in a motion to amend, you can't add to the record. You can't say something, well, if this had been raised, this is what I would say. And that's why it's very important that you limit what a motion to amend does. And if you don't raise it below.
Well, there's nothing to keep a party from asking the court for an opportunity to respond to this argument and for the court granting the parties the opportunity, particularly when the trial court addressed the subject matter.
But the court cannot allow the record to be reopened in any respect to add any further evidence. So the problem fundamentally is that if you don't present it when the parties have the opportunity to make the record, you have just precluded one party's rights. And that's why the motion to amend.
It says that a court abuses its discretion by allowing the parties to present additional evidence.
Rule 5202 doesn't allow you to do that. You can't do it under Rule 5202. Motion to amend by rule is limited to the record that was presented to the district court prior to the order or trial, whatever it may be. So the rule on its face precludes, and the case law is clear, you can't add to the record.
I must say that I have some aversion to the proposition that this subject is subject to these precise rules. We're dealing with children here and the custody and visitation of children and their best interests in the long term, and it's important that the trial court apply the correct standards in making those determinations. You're saying here because of the rules, the trial court should be precluded from considering using what arguably may be the correct standard.
Well, what I'm saying is that there are rules that guide the court through all procedures. And what the Supreme Court said in MJH, the mere fact, as I understand it, the fact that a party is moving for 50-50 doesn't in itself trigger the idea that there's de facto modification of custody. And what I understand the argument to be basically, well, the judge should have seen it because you're asking for 50-50, and that I don't see is in accord with the case law.
I just have one question.
I know you're over your time, but
because
I believe Judge Wooten had a question.
Probably your hardest argument, and that's why I want to make sure you get a chance to say something about it, is with regard to the best interest factors. What in this order can we look at as to the reasoning of the judge under the best interest factors?
As to the parenting time, yes. It's in his, in the motion for amended, or sorry, the order for amended finding, he says the totality of the circumstances. Now, what I said in my brief is that if the court finds that legally insufficient, what happens then, and the case they cite in the reply, is not a reversal, but it's a remand for more specific findings. So I want to make clear that it's never a reversal, but it's a remand. If the court concludes that in its judgment.
That case stands for the proposition that it's never a reversal or just wasn't a reversal in that case?
It's a published opinion, and it basically said if there aren't the necessary findings, I mean, you remand. And there's other cases like that, too. It's not a reversal, it's a remand.
You say there are no cases?
I'm not saying there's no cases. I can't tell you that. But I can say that the published case they cite was specifically The court said it's a remand.
All right, thank you, Ms. Hunt. And Mr. Burns, you have the last word.
Page 2 of my reply brief, I deal with the issue of the de facto review. And similar to the judge's questions here and his points, I point out that the district court in this case did not reject my argument that this was a change of custody as untimely. Instead, it expressly considered my argument and ruled that based on the totality of the circumstances, that the court was considering it. The issue was briefed by both parties. Mother's motion for amended findings appropriately argued that the court had overlooked controlling law when it found that father had satisfied the statutory requirements for the requested change, and therefore the issue was properly preserved for appeal. It is clear that this issue was presented. It's also clear that the district court considered it. It happens all the time at the district court that a judge will give an opportunity for another party to respond. I'm going to give you an opportunity to respond to that if you don't think that you had an opportunity. That frequently occurs. And one last key on this, I'm scheduling it for a review hearing and putting a date certain in there. Obviously, the parties saw that as an opportunity to again look at the parenting schedule. Respondent himself came back in and sought to take another bite of the apple and said, I know you didn't give me 50-50 last time, but you're having a review hearing. So I'm coming back in and asking for that again.
But can you point us to any case law or authority that says if there's a review hearing of a permanent grant of parenting time, that somehow tolls the time for appealing that decision?
I'm unaware of any, but I'm also, there's nothing in the decision from Judge McManus that calls it a permanent parenting schedule, just like he doesn't call it temporary, just like the other case that's been identified specifically called it temporary. In here, it didn't say this is a permanent change to the parenting schedule. I think if you read it in conjunction with, here's the parenting schedule, I'm changing it to this, and I'll see you again in August. I think the reasonable inference from that is that it's something that we're going to try out. I'm not willing to go further. I'm not willing to consider things further. Obviously, respondent thought it was still an open issue in, again, asserting his request to further expand it.
All right. Assuming that we find that this is a permanent order that should have been appealed, did the judge err, if we make that assumption, did the judge err in comparing the requested change with that prior order that was not appealed?
Yes. I think you still need to look at the incremental nature of the two orders and read them in conjunction, even if you get to the point that that's a permanent order. You can't ignore two orders within this period of time. I think that the total, you know, I heard counsel argue, well, it's only a two-day change, not one. The judge made a small a misstatement. Remembering that this was a Friday through Sunday, one night a week. That's what the party stipulated for the schedule to be. This is now 7 days a week. It is a substantial change. You have to take a big picture. The interests of justice and the recognition that this is a family law case and that these are parenting and custody decisions, the judge's ignorance of the application of the law should not be held against the best interests of this child. Thank you.
Thank you to both parties for your briefing and the arguments that are very helpful to us. We're mindful of the fact these are difficult cases when we're involving parenting time as well as a child that will soon be 10. The matters are deemed submitted and a decision will be issued by this court within the 90-day statutory time frame. Marshall, call the next case.
818-2047, State of Minnesota, respondent.